Good afternoon, everybody. In the interest of time, we're going to make introductions brief. To my left, if I have your attention, please. Rabbi Simcha Kraus, who's the, as you saw in a previous session, is setting up a Beit Din for Agunot in Riverdale. Former teaches at Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi and other places. To my right, Rabbi Shlomo Vilk, who's the more da'atra of Kilat Ya'el, and is the Rosh HaYeshiva of Yeshivat Machanaim in Efrat. Rav Aryeh Klapper, who's the head of the modern Center for Torah Leadership.
Center for Modern Torah Leadership.
We wanted to get these gentlemen together to talk about certain issues about halacha, and I wanted to start really by just throwing out a general question about what you see as the biggest areas where halacha has to change or adapt or catch up with the modern world. And I guess there's a philosophical question that's inside of that, which is how much should halacha take into account changing modern sensibilities, for example, with regard to gender or sexual orientation, and how do you define lines that are not crossable? So we'll begin with you, Rav Kraus.
Okay. Thank you very much. I understand your question, but somehow when you, may I just see the wording, the exact wording that you used? What do you see as the biggest areas where halacha has to catch up or change, etc., etc.? And how much should halacha take change of account of the modern sensibilities? And what constitutes the line that one cannot be crossed? You didn't mean it, but apparently there's a little bit of a dissatisfaction with halacha. You know, if halacha has to change and take care of modern sensibilities, etc., 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 there seems to be a kind of dissatisfaction with halacha.
How do you know I didn't mean that?
I know you didn't mean that. You didn't mean that. But we have to make clear that you didn't mean that. Because while we all speak on our respective areas, I'm sure that Rabbi Klapper and Harav Hagaon Rav Vilk, etc., etc., have spoken on things that they are serious about, and so have I about I've spoken about new business. Apparently, I wasn't satisfied either. But that idea of not being satisfied with halacha doesn't sit well with me. I'm satisfied with halacha. I think, nevertheless, that we have to put this kind of discussion in a particular frame of reference, and I'll take only a few minutes because we should not take time from other speakers. Nevertheless, I think that the frame of reference is as follows. We're soon going to have Hanukkah, correct? But after Hanukkah, the month of Teves isn't so easy either, although most people don't know that. Yeah, at the 10th of Teves, we have a fast day. Why do we fast on the 10th of Teves? That everybody knows. No, come on, tell me, you know that I want you to participate. Because besides Yerushalayim, the destruction of Yerushalayim. But you know that the 9th of Teves is also a fast day? Why? Why? Who?
Art
scroll.
They published it.
Atzko, correct. The translation of the Torah into Greek. And you know, the Gemara says that when the Torah is translated into Greek, it was a fast day. Yor d'choshech lo'ilom. The darkness descended. What's so bad with translating Torah into Greek? What's so bad with translating Torah into Greek? What's read is as follows. You know, in modern times, the Torah was translated into German. Mendelssohn translated the Torah into German, and Shamshon Hirsch. What's the difference? The difference is this. When Hirsch translated it, he translated it that Jews should learn Torah. Jews who don't know Torah should learn Torah. Mendelssohn translated it for another reason. He wanted Jews to know German. That's the difference. Let's not finish with that. So, and what happened, people, on the 8th day of Tevet? What happened on the 8th day of Tevet? So, okay, if you don't know, the Shulchan Aruch says he doesn't know either. But the fact is that in the Slichot we say that Ezra HaSofer died. Why was Ezra HaSofer the only one in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah that numbered 120 people, Mordechai and Esther, worthy of a fast day, and others not? So something happened. So because the Gemara says that Ezra was worthy of accepting the Torah like Moshe, except Tigdimo Moshe Rabbeinu. What did Ezra do? What Ezra did, in Higdimo Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Rabbeinu was first. What did Ezra do? Ezra did something very drastic. Ezra did something fantastically drastic. He changed the script of the Torah. He did something totally new. He changed. Jews forgot learning. Jews forgot the old alphabet. Jews forgot everything. And he changed the script into a new script that at that time people know. So what message do we get from this? We get the following message. That at times, when on Hanukkah we meet the world of outside, when we meet the Greek world, that causes us certain problems. Sometimes the translation of Torah into Greek is a problem. So much so that what? That there is a fast day. Why? Because when you meet the world, you sometimes can get very influenced by the world. The world beckons to you. Chachmat Yevanit, Greek knowledge, etc., etc. It's so big, it's so wonderful, it's so imposing, and you can go away from Yiddishkeit. And at the same time, we have to know that the outside world isn't so bad. As a matter of fact, Ezra changed the script. Can you imagine if somebody would change the script now, they'd say, yeah, he's a reformer, he belongs to... And after Ezra didn't reform, Ezra saved the Torah. By changing the script, you saved the Torah. Sometimes you have to know as follows. Sometimes you have to know when you fast for translating the Torah into Greek. And sometimes you have to know when you create something else. The Shulchan Aruch means he does know, people don't know who Ezra was. Ezra was the man who saved Torah. He was like Moshe Rabbeinu by changing the script, by doing that. You know, there's a famous Gemara in Menachot. The Gemara in Menachot says that Kol HaKelim She'asa Moshe Rabbeinu, Choftes, all the Kelim, all the utensils in the temple that Moshe Rabbeinu did, Aksherim Lo, the kosher for him, Uksherim Lo Dorot. You know, the Menorah of Moshe was good forever. The Kiyor of Moshe was good forever. There's only one thing that Moshe Rabbeinu's Kelim are not good for any other Beit HaMikdash. The Chatzotzrot, the trumpets. Why? Because Torah is forever. The Halacha is forever. But the way you explain Torah, the idiom for Torah, Chatzotzrot, which is what? Which is likruei ha'eda, you explain Torah. Sometimes you need chassidus, and sometimes you need philosophy, and sometimes you need rationality, and sometimes perhaps you need a little bit of Kabbalah. Not terribly much. Sometimes you need that kind of language, and sometimes you need that kind of idiom. So when my good friend Dr. Melamed asks me about halakha...
Which I note you haven't answered the question yet. What do you see as the biggest areas where halakha has to change in the modern world?
I will tell you. I, for example, because these people... I'm not exactly... I don't feel, for example, many things that go under that question of what would you change is korbanot. I don't know why. I don't have the feeling that korbanot is such a big issue. Korbanot... We have the sensibility that now it's a little ugly. But, maybe we'll get a different kind of feeling. Sensitivities change. In each generation, sensitivities change. So I don't know whether, I know what the Rambam says in Marir Ruchim, but I also know what the Rambam says in Hilchos Beis Abchira. So I don't have that. But you spoke about a particular issue. You spoke of an issue of gender. Yeah. I think that Judaism in that sense has done a great disservice to women. It did. And the halachic Judaism. But again, I don't blame it on the halacha. That's what I thought. The point is that most gender issues, let's take any gender issue. Take, for example, whether a woman could be president of a shul. I have no problem. I don't know what you have it here. But I have no problem with that. I have many halachic answers, much much better answers than what you heard on Get Zikui. No, seriously. You know, I don't think that Judaism, Moshe Rabbeinu was against women. There are certain issues that now, but I believe in general that when the Chumash says that the Rabbi Shalom created men, Zohar and Keva Baroisa, B'Tselem Elokim Baroisam, that every person is a Tselem Elokim, a woman is a Tselem Elokim. And when her Tselem Elokim is distorted, when her Tselem Elokim is embarrassed, so to say, when we deny a woman Tselem Elokim that she's also in, that she's in God's image, then I think that we have to do something better, and we can do something better. The only thing you have to, and the halacha is not a problem there. The halacha is not a problem in those things that relate to Tselem Elokim. Unless you will have a question, then we'll see. But yeah, I don't think that the halacha is a problem there, specifically in the case of gender. And if you want to find out, you can ask me later. But I must speak others.
Okay.
What?
Into the mic. So first of all, I don't have any issues with the halacha, any problems at all. I feel very comfortable with the halacha. I have problems with the gatekeepers of halacha. And this is a completely different issue, because the halacha itself, even with its name, halacha, it's to walk, it's to have Torah in motion, it's to move. And obviously, the halacha is not something, some dogma that was given to us many years ago, and this is what we should observe. It's a set of principles, of halachot, of actions, of deeds, of good deeds, of culture, that should be applied not just in a manner of new explanations, new words, philosophy, chassidut, Kabbalah, chas v'chalila, and so on, but in a much deeper way, because when halacha meets reality, the language itself transcends the halacha from one aspect to a different, completely different concept of halacha. And like the Gemara says, that when Moshe Rabbeinu have reached the Bet Midrash of Rabbi Akiva and they couldn't understand anything, so I assume that Rabbi Akiva, if he would have had Shulchan Aruch, he wouldn't imagine even this is something the Jews wrote. And when Rabbi Yosef Karo will come, not to this panel, but to this meal and to what we just said here, or what we talk here, he wouldn't understand, not because of the language, but because it's a completely unfamiliar halakha for him. So the process of halakha always continues. And basically, I think the problem is, or not the problem, the issue arose on our generation especially, because for generation it was very simple, the halacha is changing. The problem is that on our generations, all the foundations of halacha were completely changed. Because the halacha relates to, like Chassidut explains, or Kabbalah, to Zman, Makom, ve'Adam, time, man, and place. And in a sense, everything, the foundations the halacha actually lies on, are completely different in our days. Because I came from Israel on Friday afternoon, 2 hours before Shabbat. Today, I woke up at 2 a.m. And because I'm still on Israel time. And I davened at 6:30. Now, Rabbi Greizman and the Rebbetzin told me that it's before the time of the Shachrit, 6:30 in the morning. But for me, it was after 3 hours. Because I live now, right now, I live in a completely different time zone. And in a sense, and I live in Yerushalayim, and I work in Efrat, so many people there work in a time zone of the U.S. or England or Canada or whatever, because many people do make Aliyah, and they work in a different time zone. Actually, according to the information that the UN is, at least in the website of the UN, it says that 40% of the Western world, especially in India, don't work in their time zone. So it means that time is a completely different concept. And when my students, I have real difficulties in waking them up in the morning, because they live in a different time zone. Since Edison invented the bulb light, 1882, time has changed. We don't follow the sun anymore. We follow the watch. We follow our feelings. We follow the pubs, opening hours of the pubs. And in a sense, time is a completely different concept. So then it's a big problem to say, Shalosh Shaot, this is 3 hours, that's the time of Tfilat Shacharit. So the Hasidim decided long ago that they can daven whenever they want. as you all know, because time is a completely different concept. Also a place, holy places, or place where Eretz Israel, like I'm Israeli and I go around, like, there are only three reasons why you can leave Eretz Israel. One is learning Torah. Okay, so I'm here for a reason, but in many cases I go next month skiing in France. This is not under the title of the reasons why you can leave Eretz Israel. So my idea of it is that my wife is going and I'm going to search for a wife. Okay, so this is my understanding of why I can leave because this is one of the reasons that are permitted. And so on. And also, me as a person, even. Everything is changed because right now I'm sitting here, but I have a website, and people listen to me, probably to my lectures online right now. And we're spread into so many identities, completely different identities. In the internet, I'm 45 in my Facebook. I'm not 48 as I am. I wanted to be a bit younger. And there are so many issues that actually the halacha lies on so many pre-assumptions that are long gone. And in a sense, it's very hard to tell people that this is the halacha while they don't have the ground that the halacha can touch base with their life. And this is why it's not only about giving new explanations. It's about being able to live by the halacha, and this is a very difficult issue. For example, the issue of gender that Rabbi Marcus mentioned. For example, I don't mind if a woman is the president of a shul. This is not an halachic issue at all. Okay, this is very easy. But the problem is that there is no woman in this panel. And this is something that the reason, the blame is not upon Torah in Moshe. The blame is, I think, at least in my congregation, and I'm teaching in Lindenbaum and Bravendels, what used to be, that there aren't enough women that can be in this panel. Because society cannot, doesn't encouraging it. And we're not trying to make society even in the sense that women will be knowledgeable, will be part of the world of Torah, because otherwise, gender-wise, the Torah will not meet reality unless women will take part in halachic discussion and in the halachic world, for example. And so on. We can talk so much about the halacha. Now, I'm not talking about what Dr. Malamet asked about what are the borders, or how did you call it? What are the...
It doesn't seem to matter to anybody, the language I use, bichlal.
Okay.
So say whatever you like. Yeah.
So, you know... I think, at least in my opinion, is that there are so many people who are sitting on the walls and they're wall guardians that they're fighting against any change that, at least in my eyes, I never ask myself what the borders are. Because there are others that this is the only question they ask. And I'm trying to be from the inside and say not what the borders are, but what are the lights within the borders? What are the lights within the halacha? How we can elevate this world into getting into a better world? Some people know here that when I was 22, I met my wife. She was a med school student. And when I went to my Rosh Yeshiva back then, in Yeshivat Esdel, and he told me that I can't marry her. He refused to do Mesader Chuba veKiddushin because he said I was fairly a good student, a good Bachur Yeshiva. I learned Torah all the day and night. And he told me that she will remove me from being able to learn Torah and to be part of the Jewish world. He refused to marry me off, and he didn't come to my wedding because. And later on, he apologized. He called my wife and apologized. But still, this is the Baruch Hashem, I'm here. So, and we got married eventually. So things are changing, and now most of the Rashi Shivot will not say something like that. And most of our in my congregation, people, women are dancing with Sefer Torah. They learn the Megillah. Wherever it's possible, and I'm sure the borders will be pushed, because as long as there will be devoted people, women especially, to Torah, to Avodat Hashem and to the idea of taking real part in Jewish life.
Okay, so I'll start by picking up on something Rabbi Vilk said, which is I do think that there is a certain element specifically on the gender issue of arrogance in a group of men presuming to decide what the future is going to be. And so the first priority is producing women who are equal participants in the conversation, and that, in fact, is a central goal of my professional life right now, is the creation of a program which will be designed to produce women who are creative Talmudic scholars who can participate in panels like this. So there's a certain hesitation in answering the question. but I don't quite agree. I don't really agree with the rhetoric that I'm perfectly happy with the halakha as is, because halakha, as it is lived, is a human product. And so if I don't like the way the current people are interpreting the halakha, I can't deny that that is the halakha as it is, in the same way as if, as an American or as a United States citizen, so I might disagree with the way the Supreme Court currently understands the Constitution. I might say that I believe that the original intent of the Constitution is, or that the proper interpretation of the Constitution currently should be different than that offered by the current Supreme Court, but I would still be unhappy with the current state of constitutional jurisprudence if I don't like the way the Supreme Court currently understands it. Since I don't believe that I have the power to declare that the law is otherwise than the Supreme Court says it is, so by the same token, right, the theoretical possibility of a different halakha doesn't change the reality of what the halakha is, which is a product of the authorities currently in place. So I think we have to be open that there are areas where we might think that the halakha should be different and isn't the way we think it is, and that we're entitled to express dissatisfaction and to try and bring about change. And the way to bring about change is to make to produce the scholars with influence in the halakha who share one's sensibilities. So I think that's the first thing that has to be said. I do think that it's not a good idea to frame it specifically about modern sensibilities, because I think that there will be times, there have been times, when Jews lived in profoundly evil cultures. And to take the premise that the job of Torah is to keep up with whatever the mores of the society you have are, that doesn't make, right, you're going to be part of evil societies, and there are times when that would have meant keeping up with totalitarian communism, and times where that would have meant keeping up with fascism. And the whole purpose of having a tradition and having a base revelation is that you have the capacity to resist the winds of social change and not just to bend to it. So I think the question we have to ask ourselves continually is, what do we really believe is Ritzon Hashem? And then we are entitled to believe that God places us in a particular place and time because we're supposed to learn things about the right about the proper meaning of the will of God in those times. But I don't think we should ever give the answer as we have to keep up with modern sensibilities, as opposed to there are truths that we think we have to believe in. And then I think that there are times where we can say that reality has changed in ways that require a response. I'm actually going to say that to me, I want to say one other thing, which is that also we have to recognize that there are areas where there isn't currently halakha at all. There are areas where halakha has absolutely nothing to say, and when we say things about it, last night we had a panel on military ethics. I don't believe halakha currently, anybody can say with honesty, this is the halakha about military ethics, because we're in the process of constructing it. So the truth is, if you ask me where we need the largest changes in space, it's not so much changes, areas where we need to develop the halakha, and the core issue that we really need to develop the halakha is not so much gender and sexual orientation, although those are certainly issues that need to be discussed, but how halakha relates to a society in which includes people who do not see themselves as bound by halakha, but nonetheless whom we have political power over, and how halakha relates to a society in which there are both Jews and non-Jews, right, in which we have power over the general power over the lives of non-Jews, and how halakha relates to being in a society where we are a minority that is given a genuine voice in the governance of a society, about that, what the halakha is supposed to be, ask a simple question, like what should the halakha of abortion be in a democratic society in which of which Jews only compose 6% and Orthodox Jews 0.1%. Right. There is no, you can't even begin to give an answer. Forget all the lumdish discussion of what the halakha of abortion is. The first thing you'll say is, well, the halakha of abortion is this for Jews and that for non-Jews, and that's ridiculous to propose that as the policy for America. So we have not begun to have that conversation. Honestly, that to me is a much bigger conversation than the others.
I wanted to follow up on two comments here. One is what I'm hearing, the description of halakha is almost a monolithic term, right? And it strikes me that I'm wondering if there are different halachic truths and different halachic communities, and if there are, so what does that mean? Are we saying there's no one halachic truth? That's one thing that struck me when you were talking. And Rav Vilk, you know, you talked about the gatekeeper, so I'm wondering what you think would make a good gatekeeper. In other words, if somebody is a posek in halacha, what do they need to know in this day and age, and what would make them a good gatekeeper? So let's begin with the idea of different halachic communities, and what does that say about one halachic truth?
So to some extent, come at 2:15. That's really the core of the shir. But the short answer, without doing the fun intellectual games that we'll play at 2:15, is that of course there are multiple halachic truths, because the Torah, Hosefa Ur, has a marvelous distinction between constitutions and codes. Constitutions are designed to provide the values on the basis of which you construct a legal system. Codes are supposed to tell you exactly what you do. Constitutions can be concretized in many different ways. And there are lots of interacting parts, and if you change one part one way, then you have to change another part differently. Right? If you lower the penalties if you increase the standards for evidence in criminal trials, you probably increase the penalties, and if you decrease the penalties, you lower the standard. All those things interrelate. And Faur says, and I think it's convincing, that the Torah is a constitution, not a code. Right, the Torah can be concretized in many, many different ways. It doesn't have to be exactly the way we have it. And sometimes there is a value in creating a single unified understanding of halakha, in which case there could have been many, but we choose one as the law in our time, which doesn't mean it's objective truth. It doesn't mean it's the only way God could have set it up, but we think that there's a value as a community in doing it one way. And sometimes we decide that it's better to allow for variation by community and by place. The whole notion of law, right? Really, the ideal system is everyone is subjective. That undermines law. Law always requires us to override certain things, right? Certain things that are different. But we make choices about how broadly to make the law. Do we make the law for a city? Do we make the law for a state? Do we make the law for a society? Do we make the law for Ashkenazim? Do we make the law for Sephardim? Those are all choices we have to make. If you're, you know, the United States, Canada also, right? You can distinguish between, you have a federated system. So there are things that the national government has to do which are standardized, and there are things that the state government has to do. And the state government choose to leave some things to municipalities. The municipalities choose to leave some things to boroughs. There are always an infinite number of ways in which the halachic system can be constructed. We always make choices as to whether to make the halacha as we have it unified or diverse. And I think that those are among the most important decisions we make, because the price of having your autonomy and making your decisions for yourself is that you have no right to tell anybody else they're wrong. And sometimes it's worth having a struggle across the whole Torah community to decide which way it's going to be, and sometimes it's better to live and let live.
Gatekeepers. Can I start with
you?
Okay, so I think... Sorry. Okay, about the gatekeeper, what are the qualities of gatekeepers? And then maybe it will also include the previous question. First of all, I think that from three aspects. One is the halakha, the Torah, as it is, as it was given to me by my father, my mother, my grandparents, by the Shulchan Aruch. That's the first aspect. The second is the society I live in, to understand the people, to understand their psychology, their sensitivities, their culture. And the third is to understand the world, what's going on in the world. Now, in Jewish history, we have two different authorities. One is the Posek and the second is the Rav. Posek and Rav are not the same because I am not Posek, I'm a Rav. The meaning is that when I have a simple question, I answer it. But if the question is very difficult and it needs to be not just being answered by my intuition and my knowledge, but by more deeper meaning, in a sense of I need someone that knows the policy of halacha and not just how to apply it in reality. So then I go to one of my rabbanim and I ask him not for the answer but for the policy. And then I'm trying to apply it to reality. So basically, poskim, they don't need to know so much about the world, but they need to know much about halacha, the way how it works, and about people. But me as a Rav, for example, I need to know different things, because for me, I don't need, well, I learned Rabbanut, I did my Dayanut exams, I learned for many years in Yeshivot, but still, when I have a really great question, I went to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and others, and I asked them questions. So each one, basically, each one of us, I think, needs different aspects. I know my people, and he didn't. And when he gave me an answer, the answer was in principle. Like, he gave me the concept of halacha, and he told me, now you know the people and try to apply it. And obviously, when someone is coming with a chicken or with a pot and asking whether it's kosher or not, the question is whether it's Tuesday evening or Friday afternoon just before Shabbat. The answer will be different. Because the Shulchan Aruch says that there is Shat Adchak, there is a places where the answer is different than Lechatchila, like what you should do in the first place. So the Halacha is giving us, it's not just one line, one thin line, it's a broad way, which you can go through and check what reality actually wants from you. Now, if we talk about the changes, I think that, in a sense, one of the most important thing is that many communities are completely different. And many rabbanim, I know that once I went to Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, to ask about an abortion. And it was after 40 days. His opinion was that abortion can be done only after 40 days. So he sent me to Rav Waldenberg, to a different Rav that is matir to do, that is allowing to do abortion later. He didn't want to answer, but he knew that it's a grave question. It was a very difficult question, so he decided not to answer, but he sent me to another Gdol Ador to give me an answer that I wanted. This, not me, but this one of my congregation back 25 years ago wanted. So basically, he said, I cannot rule the halacha you want, but I know there is someone who can, so please go to him and he will give you the answer. And the minute I went there and I told Rav Waldenberg, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach sent me, so he didn't even ask what the question is. He said, it's okay. Because he knew that when someone is being sent to him about a question of abortion is because this is what Rav Shlomo Zalman expects him to answer. So the halacha is something, obviously, that different communities or different rabbanim, obviously, shivim panim la Torah. The only thing which is interesting, and this is my last thing, is the ceremonies. I think basically the outfit of the halacha, like the way we celebrate the halacha, leila seder, weddings, brit milah, bar mitzvah, all those ceremonies basically are the most important ones not to change. Like that if someone from one community moves to the other and he goes to a wedding, he goes to a Brit Milah or to Shiva house, Leavdil, he will feel comfortable with the way that the community represents itself in its ceremonies. And in a sense, I think that most of the poskim, there are many answers about it, took special care about not giving answers about ceremonies which are different than ceremonies of the next community. And this is a very important concept that I think that is still being preserved now, and this is what actually holds society, even with different communities, it's their ceremony.
I don't disagree with what the speaker said so far, but I think that there has to be a little bit of a different emphasis. We think of halacha as a certain set of formulas, you know, If you ask what a halacha is, you open the Shulchan Aruch, if you open Simen Kof Nud Vav, and you'll find an answer. As if the halacha is set, etc., etc., etc. I don't think this is correct. Just as a scientist is not somebody who knows all the formulas in physics 1 or physics 2 or physics 9, a scientist is something else. What is a scientist? A scientist is a person who thinks as a physicist. There's halachic thinking. There's halachic methodology. And when we want to know the halacha, it's not enough to look up a book. You know, for example, I think that the rabbis will agree with me here. There's, I believe, a myth that exists that we all do what the Rama says. You know, the Shulchan Aruch is the Rav, the Sfarim call him the Rav, the Beis Yosef, and the Rama. Yeah, for many things we do what the Rav says, what the Rama says. But do we all do what the Rama says? There's somebody by the name of the Aruch HaShulchan who passed different than the Rama. There's somebody by the name of Nishibur, the Chofetz Chaim, who did different than the Rama. There's somebody by the name of the Vilna Gaon who did different than the Rama. In other words, and that is, I think, the strength of the halacha. That there's a thinking, and that thinking, by the very fact that it's not set in stone, that lends to a certain kind of flexibility and a certain kind of movement that we do so in halacha. I'll give you a wild example. At one, check the Shulchan Aruch. Whether, for example, somebody who doesn't see, or somebody's blind, or somebody's deaf, is you could take him to a minyan. You can be mitzaref him to a minyan. What will the Shulchan Aruch say? There are problems. We know very well that today, with the wonders of cochlear implants, there's no such toya. Even though technically doesn't hear, but with the implant he hears. And he'll be mitzaref to a minyan. That doesn't mean that halacha changed. It means that reality changed. And it means that I have the knowledge how to view this new reality. There will soon be renal advances, not in renal, advances in the ophthalmology system, and we'll see that changes. Not because the halakha changes, but because the reality changes, and knowing the methodology of halakha, I don't look up the book and say X, Y, Z, I do it something else. And that's extremely important. Well, when you discuss the concept of halacha, and when you discuss the concept of flexibility, and when you discuss what, for example, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with Rabbi Clapper, but he did make an equation. The constitution is the Torah. You said?
I did say that.
Go ahead. Yeah, the only thing is that, you know, there can be amendments to the constitution, and they could be, you can even change the constitution. And I don't believe you can change Lo Tirtzach. I don't believe, you know, in other words, that kind of model that you're thinking of is good to begin with, but it's problematic in the sense, and maybe I misunderstood you, and I probably did, but I just don't know whether these kind of equations from jurisprudence will always work in an understanding of halakha.
I didn't make the equation to the Constitution for the purpose of amendment. I made the Constitution for the purpose... For the purpose of interpretation. I think the question of the ways in which there are amendment procedures and under which there are no amendment procedures to Torah, that's clear. There are amendment procedures to even baseline halakha, emergency procedures and things like that, but I think that's probably beyond the scope of this conversation. But I wasn't setting up a precise analogy. Fowler doesn't talk about the U.S. Constitution. He says there are ways of interpreting constitutions which are different than ways of interpreting statutes, and those require, right, and those have to be understood.
I just want to add one thing as far as this is concerned. One moment. You know, just in 1930, as late as 1938, they still thought that there's going to be a Jewish state before the Shoah. Had there been a Jewish state before the Shoah, other things would have happened too. So at that time, there's a fantastic letter that Chaim Moshe Grudzinski sent to Rav Herzog at the time. Yeah, Rav Kook was dead in 1935. To Rav Herzog at the time. And he said, I know there's going to be a Jewish state, said Chaim Moshe, but, and I also know that you can't have in the Jewish state the implementation of the halacha that somebody who steals pays kefel, double, or somebody who steals becomes an eved ivri. That you can't, but make certain that certain things of the new you spoke of a constitution in Eretz Yisrael, should reflect Torah thought. What did he mean? What he meant to say, that you use your halachic methodology to make sure that what I think he meant to say is what today became known as Mishpat Ivri. You know, you could apply. Unfortunately, it wasn't so easy. But at least there was this idea at the start.
Well, just a few words about constitutions and amendments. So the Rav said that there are no amendments to the Torah because it's not like the constitution that was written by the forefather, I don't know, like of the American society. And the example was Lo Tirzach, and it's funny because the Zohar says that you know that there are two ways of laning the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, two different Teamim. So the Zohar says that in one way you can read Lo Tirzach, you shall not kill. And the other, there's a psik, there is a comma, no, kill. Lo, tirzach. So the Zohar actually is giving us one amendment to the Torah and says that to say lo tirzach will eventually, if it's with a exclamation mark, lo tirzach, never, it means that you can't kill in a war. It means that you can never kill someone who is Mechalel Shabbat. According to the Torah, this is the punishment because the Torah was so definite about it. But the fact that it, by reading it differently, we can find ways to say, no, this is where you should kill. So in a sense, the way you read is eventually a commentary. And my sense is, for many years now, that Chazal were, it's amazing what we did. Because we have the Sefer Torah and the Aron, like the scrolls that we lay on Shabbatot and Monday and Thursday. But there is also the Chumash in Chumash, the same words, exactly the same letters, the same psukim, the same verses. But we have it as a book in our cabinet, on my table. This is the Torah Shebichtav, and this is Torah Shebealpeh. The same book exactly, when it's in the Aron HaKodesh, I can't touch it, I can't write on it, I have to follow exactly the rules. If the poor guy who's laying has some small mistake, everybody's yelling at him, you know, on Shabbatot. On the other end, I give the Chumash to my kid who is five years old. I can do whatever he wants with him. He can write his name, he can commentate, he learns Chavruta and he do whatever he wants. And this is Torah Shebe'al Peh. This is the way how we bridge between the Torah and the book and the constitution where you can put amendments on and you can deal with it. So it's the same book, but we separated those two aspects, the one that came from heaven and the one which was given to people. And the commentary began by the process of moving it from the Aron HaKodesh to the written world of people, the Chumash instead of the Torah.
You said before that the posek does not need to know about the world, unquote. Well, now you're saying less. You say he doesn't need to know about the world. But that he just needs to know about the halakha, you said, and then the Rav can interpret that. I'm wondering if that has engendered universal agreement here across the panel.
No.
You don't agree?
No.
Tell me why.
I don't agree at all. I think the notion that a posek, I think that it's a fascinating distinction that there's a sort of pure, pristine halakha that is produced by people in hermetic isolation from the world, who are then willing to give up the power to apply that to a rav, who they give complete discretion, is neither, maybe it's true in certain areas in Israel, it has no relationship to the experience of the American rabbinate, where the quote unquote poskim give the rabbis very narrow leash, nor do I believe that the halakha, the halachic process, the halachic system is produced without relationship to reality. Most important policy decisions require certainly deep knowledge of reality, deep knowledge of political reality, deep knowledge of sociological reality, deep knowledge of the people. I don't believe that it would be wise to create this bifurcation where poskim exist in dark rooms somewhere and they produce a Torah that is unaffected by reality, and then we leave it to other people entirely to apply it. It's a fascinating system. I don't think it's true in reality in America. I doubt it's true in reality in Israel, and I wouldn't support it.
You see, I don't think you believe that either. That's the
no,
funny,
but
that's
well, no, I mean less, but still, this is what Rav Soloveitchik suggested in Isha Halacha, that the halachic man, halachic person, is completely isolated. He doesn't have only when you daven you have windows. Otherwise, when you learn, you don't have windows to the wall.
Chas v'shalom, Rav Soloveitchik didn't mean that.
That's what he wrote. I don't know. I didn't meet him, but I met his writing.
Excuse me, Rav Soloveitchik said that the halacha, the halachic person, looks at reality differently. For example, he gave the example, a Jew goes out on Yom Kippur at sunset and sees a beautiful sunset, and that's what happened. He went out with his father, Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe said, indeed, that sunset is different because the forgiveness of Yom Kippur comes at sunset. The halachist goes and looks at water. He doesn't see water. He sees a lake. He sees a mikveh and its dimensions and so on and so forth. The reality is different. The halacha imposes itself on the reality. But obviously, the posek, in this case, I disagree with Rabbi Volk. The posek has to know that you don't pask in a shaila. You're passing a case to the person. You yourself gave the example. When you ask the shaila about the chicken erev Shabbos and you can't cook anymore, and if the chicken is strafe, you won't have a Shabbos meal. The halacha of covered Shabbos and covered yontif tells you that any kula, any ease that you do, you're passing the kula, and so on and so forth. There's that famous dichotomy. In America, they call it the town and gown dichotomy. You know, the difference between the academic who is in his upstairs circle and between the physicist and the engineer, okay, if you wish. And there's this dichotomy between the rabbi and the posek. But a rabbi and the posek, a posek to be worthy of his name, can pasken. Yeah, the aguna. Theoretically, she is not aguna. I can't help it. But if he sees the pain of the aguna, etc., etc., he will find something to be matir. And that's what great people did. There's in yeshiva a dichotomy. Why is the Aruch HaShulchan is many times the mekil, takes it easy. The Mishneh Berurah is machmir. Do you know why? Because the Mishneh Berurah was a Rosh Yeshiva. He was in his high world there, etc., etc. And the Aruch HaShulchan was a rabbi of a city. Here he was responsible for the chickens on Shabbos and for the mikveh and for the Erev. And if he would pass him, one thing is no good, there would be catastrophe. And I think that these days the dichotomy has sharpened because we go to the reshiva, everything the reshiva. Unfortunately, it happens because Rabbanim have been neglected. I must tell you the psychology of that. I know the name Irving Yunam means something to you, but he was a great philanthropist, etc., and he was always invited to speak. At one time, he came to the dinner of Chaim Berlin, and he spoke. And when he spoke, he said, and the Moshe was the guest of honor. I don't exactly know, but the Moshe Feinstein was there. He says, and the Moshe Feinstein introduced him. He says, you know what the Moshe Feinstein is? All the musmachim, he says, of Chaim Berlin, you don't need to learn Yoredeya or Shulchan Aruch. All you have to do is put on the back of your smicha the telephone number of the Moshe Feinstein, and that's all you have to do to become Rabbanim. So everybody had a nice laugh, etc., etc. And I went over to him and I said, Mr. Bunim, you should apologize, but I think you insulted rabbis. What you're really saying is that Rabbanim don't have to grow and they don't have to learn and they don't have to develop. All they have to do is take it easy and call them Moshe Feinstein anything. That's a fantastic put down of rabbis and it's an abdication of leadership.
One of the things that we haven't talked about, you mentioned it slightly before, but that is obviously really a modern change, is halakha and sovereignty, right? And sovereignty and the state of Israel. Okay. So how does regaining sovereignty in the state affect halakha? It's been pointed out many times that the halakha seems to have originated in a kind of exile mentality, perhaps through powerlessness, and does it need to be radically rethought once Jews have control over their destiny? And on parallel lines, I might ask, how does the halachic system function in a modern state where it, in theory on the books, it contains restrictions on all sorts of things that we take for granted, like women testifying in court and so on and so forth?
I'm first?
You're first.
It's not fair.
Want to be second? You can be second.
Okay, well, it's very complex issue with the relation between the church and the state in Israel, like the synagogue, whatever. Because first of all, about women testifying, halachically, women can testify almost about anything in a beit din, not in a court, obviously in a court, but also in a beit din halachically. Just a misunderstanding. Like people say it, but in most cases, unless it's chuppah and kiddushin and get and very, very specific things, women can testify of anything halachically. Okay, so it's not what people say that they're not, we don't believe women and stuff, it's wrong. It used to be like that, but halachically there was a huge progress for centuries now, and halachically they can testify. But the problem is bigger, because in Israel there are so many problems with halacha and the state, in Chevrat HaChashmal, like electricity company, gas company, phone company, Intel, all over the country, and there are many, many problems. My opinion is, first of all, that there shouldn't be any laws that are religious laws in the country. There should be a complete separation between the Israeli law and the halakha. Halakha is something that you can educate by people. You cannot enforce it on people by law. Every time the halakha touches the law, it's a failure. They sell chametz. No, those who... The only stores who are observing Shabbat are those that need the Tudat Kashrut, but not in Tel Aviv, where they don't need because they have enough people to buy on Shabbat. So they open on Shabbat. The law of Shabbat, there is a law in Israel, cannot be applied. We should leave it to Meretz, the left-wing party, which is a completely secular party. They also, for Shabbat, observe that stores will be closed on Shabbat. We should leave them the fight. It's a citizen... question of the citizenship and not the halakha. The laws of chazir, of selling pig in Israel, obviously you can buy non-kosher meat wherever you want, unless it's the tea area. So there should be a complete separation between the law and the kashrut, not between the environment. Maybe we should, the Ministry of Education, we should learn more Tanakh, more Talmud, maybe other things. But otherwise, I think that the state of Israel actually corrupted the halakha in a sense where Batei Din, for example, throughout the Jewish history, the Dayan was appointed by the people. Okay, the congregation, the community, some communities appointed Dayan. Now he is being appointed from above, and he's not answering to us. He's answering to those who are above him. So usually, when the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, came to Spain, so he's saying that many things in Spain, he came from Ashkenaz to Spain, many things he didn't like. But he said, well, I must keep quiet because, he writes it, I must keep quiet because this is the will of the community. Because he was appointed by them. The problem is, when Rabbanim are being appointed by the state, instead of by the people, in Israel, no doctor is being appointed by the state. The state is giving you the authority, the license, and then you go and they choose you. In Israel, for some reason, they give you the title of a rabbi, of a dayan, and then the state is appointing you. This is a disaster. I think it's a bad thing, and it should be like any other profession. It should be they should be elected by the people and not by the government, because this is why it's so. The system is, I never imagined to be Dayan, even though I learned and made all the exams, because I've been in Batei Din, and in many cases it's Chilul Hashem Gadol. Okay.
I'm assuming from what you're saying, if I follow you correctly, that you'd be in favor of a civil marriage alternative in Israel. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, it happened. So it's not about I'm in favor or not. People are getting married as they want. Two aeroplanes every week are going to Cyprus.
Oh, but I meant in Israel.
In Israel, yeah, because anyhow, that's the case. So we should talk about education. We should talk about so many people are getting married, not by rabbis, just because the state is enforcing it. And more people will get... I see it. I have two couples a week that I'm... Mesader Chuppah veKiddushin, I see it always. And in any other term, now the other side is obviously that because of the state of Israel, there are more Lomdei Torah, there are more yeshivot, there are more people who are observant. We live in the most wonderful era of Judaism ever in Jewish history. in the sense of respecting Torah, in the sense of people who really have any connection to Torah. It was never like that in Jewish history. Most of the people never even knew how to read and write, Jews. And until 150 years ago, only 30% of Jews knew how to read and write. It was much more than the non-Jews, but still, most of the people never even met the Torah. The religion because there was no other way. They couldn't assimilate because there's no way to do it. But otherwise, they were not really into their identity. And now, even those who are removed from Judaism, they do kiddush, they do something, they're part of the ceremonies, they understand, all of them learn Torah, in a sense. So I think that the State of Israel did great service to Judaism, but together with this service, it did lots of harm, and this harm should be fixed.
Yeah. I would say, really, the only, on the narrow issue, the only reason to oppose civil marriage in the State of Israel is the risk of war with Cyprus. Whose economy is sustained by the... I think we should be very cautious about that. I want to go back to Rabbi Krauss mentioned a letter from Chaim Ozer to Rav Herzog. I think that we should. There's a book that probably should be translated, and if it hasn't been, I don't think it has been, and it should be much more famous. Is Rav Herzog actually produced the multi-volume work which he called A Halachic Constitution for the State of Israel? And in that book, it began with a list of the takanot, with a list of the explicit legislative change or amendments, if you will, to the corpus, not to Torah, but to the corpus of halacha as it existed and as it could reasonably be changed through interpretation. And included a whole list of takanot about the status of women, and a whole list of takanot about the status of Gentiles, and a whole list of takanot about the status of non-observant Jews. In the era preceding the state, you can find many articles by prominent halachic thinkers who said that, obviously, if we get a state, we will have to completely transform the nature of halacha, and that this is an opportunity for what we might call a constitutional convention. When we sit together and we rethink how we're going to construct the halachic system from first the principles of the text of Torah, or at least going back to the Tanitic era. It didn't happen. There was insufficient support gained for that kind of rethinking, and the halachic system continued essentially as it was without any fundamental reorientation. Worse, and I think this is what Rav Vilka is talking about, the political compromise that was reached allowed the keepers of halacha to conceive of themselves as an interest group within the state who occasionally had the capacity to exercise the power of the state over people who did not share their principles at all. That, I think, is disastrous and corrupting, and by all means we should have turned that down. We should never want power over people for whom we will always have to be coercive, who don't have any fundamental underlying share of values. The question is, it is 66 years later, and the prospect of a constitutional convention of that sort, I think, is long gone. All right, I think the note, right, because we can't say, oh, look, everything is different, we have to change, we've gone on for 66 years. Right, it's not likely that we're ever going to gain the consensus for that kind of thing. So at this point, we have to say is that, look, there are enormous gaps which have happened because of this system where we have halacha spending endless amounts of time about trying to enforce hopelessly rules about marriage, and halachic thinkers on the whole have absolutely nothing to say about the economic organization of Israeli society. Right, which is what halacha has whole sections which are just about, right, which just about how you set up safety nets, labor laws. Right, halacha has almost nothing to say, which is pathetic, because halacha has a tremendous amount to say, but it's almost nothing to say which is updated about the relationship between employers and employees, and we haven't, let alone adapting to the fact that it used to be a socialist society, it isn't anymore. Right, and where does religion play in on those things? So there are enormous gaps that we haven't filled because halachic figures took authority over the wrong things. We have places where we haven't figured out what to do with the reality of a society which includes multiple kinds of people who don't share our premises. And what do we have to say about that? I don't believe, really, that a Rav Herzog style revolution, or really, or natural but fundamental evolution is likely to happen in the short run. But I think that the gaps are there. We need to figure out how, through the mechanisms we have. I'll say one thing, just theoretically, to close off. When you have to make a radical change in halakha, that means you failed. Right? Because if halakha is, in fact, constantly relating to the society as the society moves, then you would never need to make a radical change. The problem we have is that often we have failed to be attentive to the way halakha plays out in the lives of real people. And so we're stuck with dead ends where you have to do radical things. You have to go back to principles of halakha the way it was 200, 300, 500 years ago in order to get the results you need. Since those interpretations are often not convincing, so that's the time when you actually need takanot. The challenge is we're in a vicious cycle, because to make takanot, to make radical changes within the nature of the system, requires authority. Authority requires trust. And the reason you need those changes is precisely because trust has broken down, because you have this gap developing between the experience of the people and the experience of the rabbis, and the critical need that we have is to rebuild trust between the people who live halakha and the scholarly elite, who in large measures make the decisions about halakha, because the kinds of changes that are necessary, that are possible in the system, cannot happen without building a trust relationship.
So in the interest of time, I'm going to just move to a last question, and just do it with a little bit of a autobiographical preface. Everybody up here has, you know, are teachers of adults, but are also teachers of younger people. And I'm sort of interested, of younger people, and I'm interested in the relationship of halakha, especially to the values and mores of young people. And I'll give an example that's sort of a little bit controversial now in the States and usually gets pounced on, but I'm interested in what's underneath it. So here's the story. There's a man in Colorado whose name is Yossi Goldstein, and he's an app developer. And he's developed what he calls, quote, a Shabbos app, which he says allows the user to text without violating Hilchot Shabbat. Now, I'm going to preface by saying I know nothing about the app, and I know nothing about how it works in terms of halakha, but I bring it to you. He says, quote, our main goal is to let people who are already texting on Shabbat, like it's a done deal, know that they can text on Shabbat and not completely fall off the derech. They are already keeping half Shabbos because they find that they can't get off their phones, and they feel like once they're already breaking Shabbos, they might as well give up on other mitzvot as well. Hopefully this will alleviate that, unquote. Now, as I said, I don't know the specs of the app. I don't know whether it entails halachic violation or not, but I am interested, I am curious in general, how all of you would respond to trends like this.
Okay. I have a short answer. I don't know much about electricity and so on and so forth, but since I'm in Toronto, there is a rabbi, he should be well, Rav Nachum Rabinowitz, is a great, great Talmud Chacham, who is now in Israel, who in one of his Torat Nachum, has a question whether the so-called electricity that is in computers, which is not the real electricity but LED, etc., whether that's real Chilul Shabbat. And he comes to the short conclusion, again, I'm not an expert, that this is not Chilul Shabbat. The answer may be found in his original tshuva. But I'm saying it only because that question was asked, and I don't know enough of this to answer you a regular chat whether this is possible. But I will tell you something very interesting. There's something else that we all know about, and I'm only throwing it out. The real regular electricity, old style electricity, 50 years ago, and up to now, before it will be taken over by something new. You know very well that the definition of electricity as Chilul Shabbos comes to a big machlok as there was between the Chazon Ish Zatzal and the Pshalim Zalman Orzbach Zatzal. The Chazon Ish felt that electricity is real Chilul Shabbos. It's not even, it's bona, it's not making fire, it's something else. If Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was still the last moment felt that it's only the Rabbanan, at worst it's a Rabbanan, it's never the, it's not a Daraisa. Because he was younger than the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish was accepted, he gave in. Okay, fine, so it's only a Machleika, he gave in to the older person. Lately, there has been a biography, the first serious intellectual biography of the Chazon Ish, written by Benny Brown, a great, great scholar, an academic scholar in Israel. And he says that the Chazon Ish knew, that's what he says, I'm not, he says, Benny Brown makes the assertion, that the Chazon Ish knew that perhaps halachically, from a pure halachic standpoint, the way Brisker would define halacha, that maybe Reb Shlomo Zalman is right. But he felt, he made a meta-halachic decision that he would decide that because if you allow electricity, etc., etc., and everybody will speak on the phone, on the old phones, and so on and so forth and so forth, Shabbat will become a weekday, and he didn't want that to happen. But essentially, if it's true, it's an admittance that it was a meta-halachic decision. And if that was a meta-halachic decision, then apparently, and Klal Yisrael accepted that we have to start thinking seriously about these kind of issues. What kind of legitimacy they have? The Chazon Ish, it's difficult to say. Chazon Ish was the Chazon Ish, you know. But nevertheless, if he made that admittance, and if it's correct, then we have to start thinking about this, whether it's a policy issue or it's a pure halachic issue.
I was interviewed to the Israeli radio by Rav Aviner last week, and about Hanukkah and Western tradition, culture versus Jewish culture. And the first question he asked me was, what's really the difference between Western culture and Jewish culture? And I used the old joke, and I told him that it used to be 500 years, today it's 10 years. Because in many cases, what used to be a dressing of Russian whatever became the dressing of Haredim in our era. And in many cases, we're using here Western society, those microphones, even this bottle of water. Everything here is the product of the Western society. And my feeling is, and I asked many rabbis about it in Israel, I can give you the names afterwards, about this question of electricity. I spoke to Reb Nachum Rabinovich. He's, my son went to Ma'ale Adomim, he's a Shiva in not too far from Yerushalayim. He was there for 5 years, my son. And his opinion is that indeed LCD screens are okay on Shabbat. And he says that the problem is, wait. Don't jump to conclusion. But the problem is that the categories, the Lamed Tet Avot Melacha, the 39 Melachot that the Chazal are saying, the prohibitions on Shabbat, they don't meet the high tech of today. They meet the high tech of their generations. But the idea was of the list of those melachot, those actions that had been prohibited, was that high tech is prohibited. That everything that is creatively too much, not just because you know that the Midrash, for example, way before the Mishnah, the Midrash says that you shouldn't open a book on Shabbat. You shouldn't learn on Shabbat. You shouldn't touch even a plate or a spoon. This was the ancient halacha. And then, when high tech became low tech, it was okay. And we see it in Ilchot Mukte, for example. Barishona, at first, everything was prohibited because it was high tech. But then, as long as low tech became high tech because plates and spoons and everything became a daily thing which didn't represent a human creation, yitzirah enoshit, just something plain, it was permissible. And in a sense, what Rav Rabinovich said, that this is the case about our high tech. We can't find place to put computers in halachically based on the ancient concepts or in a chart. We can't put them exactly on the right place on a chart. But we know that if you draw a line from Chazal to the Rishonim to the Achronim, and you from the dots, and you draw a line, you meet the same concept, which actually says that the computer is prohibited on Shabbat. Not the, because, even though you can't put it in some place halachically, but still it's the meta halacha. It's the idea of this actually will destroy our Shabbat. But in a sense where computers will become so part of us, and the world is, even today, like everything, so now we can manage without a cell phone. So my answer about this app is that it's completely prohibited. It's better than those kids will know that they are Mechalele Shabbat, and their teacher will know that you shouldn't make reduction to this guy into where he is Mechalele Shabbat. So instead of telling him, listen, even though this is prohibited, it's okay. I accept you where you're okay. And I think this is better than one side is, if you do that, you're not Jewish, you're not part of us. And the other side, so it's okay. It's better to let them know that it's against the idea of Shabbat. It's against what we want them to do on Shabbat. But since you're addicted and whatever, you can't do without it. Okay, so I'll close my... I can't do anything about it, but still I will accept you the Shulchan HaSeder. Okay, not as the Ben Rasha, but maybe the one who knows how to text. I don't know. The idea is to keep it prohibited. I don't think it's right now, but maybe the next generation, the generation after, where text will replace the speech even, like people will, instead of talking, will text people. So maybe then it will become low tech, and then we will talk.
Rabbi Clapper, you have the last word.
So I think the first part where I will agree, I think that many of us understand that a primary lesson from the relative experience of Orthodox and Conservative Judaism in North America over the past 50 years is that you don't change the halakha to approve of actions that people are doing anyway. Right, that all that does is undermine respect for the halakha. So in that sense, I just think it's sociologically a really right. It's much better idea. It's much better educationally. It's much better idea sociologically that if people are doing things wrong, that you make decisions about whether it's worth throwing people out of the community because of the wrong things they do. And texting on Shabbat would be a very bad idea to throw people out of the community for that. But it will do no good at all to tell people that things they're doing in violation of the law are not that we're going to change the law to match that. I agree with that entirely. I also agree entirely that we need to be aware that we're going to have to rethink the decisions that have been made about halakha and electricity, because it will become impossible to live with some of the halakha as we have it. Give you two examples. One is Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, who was a famous Haredi lecturer, was asked at one point whether it was permitted to walk in front of security cameras on the street because you're changing the image. My brother-in-law was there and pointed out that probably if it's a sort of walk in front of security cameras, it's a sort of walk outdoors on Shabbat because there are CIA satellites overhead. Certainly in London, there are cameras, right? There are cameras. We now know, right after watching some of these tragedies, that there are cameras all along the streets in most neighborhoods. There's a fellow in London who sued because his condo association put a motion detector in the hallway outside his apartment. So if you hold that you can't pass a motion detector which will turn on a light, so then anybody who doesn't like you can trap you in your house by just putting them right. Those are not viable conditions, and we're going to have to rethink them. Now, here's what I would say. I have a shiur I call A Brief History of Timers. Now, the timer for Shabbat was invented as a theoretical phenomenon in the 16th century by Rabbi Yaakov Hagiz, who came up with the interesting idea that you could, he was trying to solve a technical problem in the Gemara, and he came up with the idea that what you could do is you could take a very, very long fuse, right, put your pot of meat over here, have a long, right, put fuel, put a long, tie a long string around the fuel, 24, right, light it before Shabbat, and it would slowly burn its way. I can watch we're in the Wile E. Coyote cartoons. And finally, when you get there on Shabbat, it costs fire. Now, this actually, in the 18th century in Frankfurt, the Sam Sofer reports, they actually had coffee Friday night this way. Right, that was the first Shabbat clock. In the late 19th century, people started coming with clever ideas to have cholent on Shabbat, of which the coolest was you would hang a magnifying glass over the courtyard of the shul so that the sun would strike at a particular angle and it would focus the rays onto the fuel, and the fuel under the cholent pot, under the meat pot, would light. That way you could have a hot cholent. Nobody thought these were an issue. Everybody agreed that these were in principle okay. And then all of a sudden, Rav Moshe Feinstein realizes that, oh my goodness, once we have electric ways to do this, we can do anything this way. And Shabbat will be indistinguishable from the weekday. Now, and he said, oh my goodness, how could we possibly allow this? But there was a counter argument, which is, Chazal already, right, they distinguished us from the Sadducees, that we light fires before Shabbat because we don't want you to be cold. Right? That's why we have cholent. And so Rav Moshe fought a losing battle all these years, which he said you can use timers for light, but you can't use them for air conditioners. You can use them for air conditioners, but you can't use them for dishwashers. All right, I got the question first about dishwashers, and I said, well, you know, Rav Moshe said, I don't know. Rav Moshe says, actually, by the way, what he says is, you can use it for this, but not for that, although there is no known basis for distinguishing. That right? That's the language that's true. Apel pish ein yodua tam l'chalik. And another place he says, this is a thing which is, it is appropriate to forbid, although it is not forbidden. So he went from only lights to lights and air conditioning. I got the question about dishwashers. It turned out that my in-laws had asked him the question about dishwashers, and he had allowed that too eventually. Because over time it turned out, it became the case that the spirit of Shabbat was harmed by the prohibition as opposed to helped. Now, the interesting thing to me is I have interviewed a number of teenagers, some of whom are related to me. And I've asked them, and I said, suppose I were to tell you that it was okay to text on Shabbat. Would you? And so far the answer has universally been no. Because it would feel like it feels like a complete violation of the spirit of Shabbat. Now I don't know if that will be the case in 30 or 40 years, but I think it's great to have occasions, and we should be aware of occasions where the sensibility of the teenagers are actually much more machmir than those of the rabbis who are perhaps more into the conceptual nature.
I'm just going to spend 1 minute thanking these people. I think you have to understand that these are three very, very special people. And I know two-thirds of that from personal experience. Rabbi Clapper I just met for the first time. I've heard him speak several times. He's actually a remarkably thoughtful individual. He's a very creative person, and I look forward to many conversations with him in the future. Rav Vilk and I have been friends for 16 years. We taught together at Chat. I now daven at, we live 5 minutes away from each other, and we daven at his kila, and we also teach together at Machanaim, where he is the Rosh Yeshiva. You can close your ears, because I'm going to say nice things now. You have no idea how remarkably creative and wise this person is. He was humble before about not poskening shaylot. People come to him all the time for all sorts of complicated things, and he helps them with humility, and he helps them with a great deal of wisdom. Rav Krauss, who I didn't know at all, came to me from the best source possible, which was my son, who learned with him, and came home the first day and said, I said, how was it? And he said, Abba, and you got to know my son, if anybody knows my son Akiva, has high standards, right? Said, like that, for about 5 seconds, it was amazing. And continued to say that the whole year where he sat in his shir. So we're really blessed to have you here. It was a very fascinating conversation. Thank you very, very much.